even if you have no religious or moral convictions or opinions and that kind of thing, you have to admit that in terms of social change in the course of human history, things have never happened so fast in human history as they do right now, right? Like, it takes usually throughout history generations to change social ideas. And in this country, what we've seen happen over the last 5 or 6 years has just been lightning quick compared to the rest of history. And so it leaves us sometimes trying to catch up, you know, in our heads. Like, some of us here, I think, this week, we're like, some of us here I know are yay, and some of us are here, I have deep concerns, and some of us are just like, I don't know what to think. It's happening so fast. I don't even know how to process things that are happening so fast. And I saw this week, and I thought that just captures this last week better than anything I've seen, right? Like, that just, that's it, right? And so, it's funny that last week we spent time talking about the thing down in Charleston, and then I said to Dustin this week, I've had this idea for a long time that it'd be fun to do a series sometime where we would just come in on Sunday mornings. It's too much pressure. I'm not this smart or able to do this. But I've always thought it'd be fun to come in on Sunday morning and just have a table here and open up the newspaper and then say, let's reflect theologically on the news, which would have been brilliant if I would have done that series this month, right? Like, we could just open the paper and said, what's here? And let's talk about it. Most of the year, I'm just scared because then we'd talk about stray cats and Peoria or something. But I just thought it would be important this morning for us to remind each other what kind of church we are. That there's a lot of churches, and this is not critical, it's just the reality, is that there's churches all over our country this morning, some of whom are celebrating in service this morning, and some who are saying that this is the darkest day in American history, darker than 9/11 kind of thing. Like, there's people that have said those kinds of things, right? And so there's probably, I would guess, in most churches in America, there's something being said. Some pastor somewhere right now is standing up like I am and reminding their people that this is the party line. This is what we believe. This is what's right. And so I think it's important in these moments to remind ourselves of what kind of church we are, because we're not like a lot of those churches in that we honor the dignity of each other's journey. Which means that not all of us are on the same page about any given issue. And when I scan through my Facebook feed and count the rainbows and count the knots, you know, there's a good mix in my feed, because in this room, we don't all think the same things about everything. In fact, there's very few things, I think, in this church that we all agree on. We agree on this, right? This. And for us, that's enough. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to say a couple things, and then we're going to do this together, because this reminds us of who we are and why we gather. And so the couple things I want to say is, early this year, back in, was it January of this year? No, January of a year and a half ago, or maybe last fall. I don't know when it was. We did a series called Big Tent. That was last fall, wasn't it? It was almost a year ago. We did a series that we called Big Tent, and we talked about what we're trying to be here, and that we're trying to be, as a church, a big tent, a place where whatever you think about things, wherever you are in your journey, that we want to create safe spaces for each other, and we want to love each other despite our differences. And we don't want to actually just set those aside, but we want to bring those into the conversations and loving conversations. And so I just want to remind us of what it means to live in the big tent for a couple minutes. I wrote some things down, and then I'm going to read scripture. The things I wrote down, when I started writing these down yesterday, I wrote here's what side A needs to hear, and here's what side one needs to hear. Remember that language of side A and side one? But then I got done, and I was like, wait a minute, I think everybody needs to hear all of this. And so here's just some of the thoughts I had is, you won't change anyone by telling them that they're wrong. It doesn't matter how clever the article is, or how clever your profile picture is, or how clever the blurb that you put on Twitter was. You won't change anybody by telling them that they're wrong. You won't change anyone by challenging them to an intellectual duel. Love is the only pathway to transformation. Love is the only pathway to transformation. We are changed by God's love for us. We're changed in loving relationships with each other. That's what causes us to change. I've never once sat on Facebook and said, well, that post, in 140 characters or less, that person just changed my life. It just doesn't, none of us, that it does, that's just not a thing. Love is the only pathway to transformation. and not a generic I love people, because there's lots of people out there saying, I love everybody, but this is the ways that you're wrong. No, not just generic I love people, but specific, here's how I'm in your life, I love you. Here's how you know I love you. You don't know that somebody loves you because they say it. You know somebody loves you because they show you that they love you. Over and over again, repeatedly through time and space, right? In very tangible ways. And so if we're actually going to say that we love each other, then we're going to do it by showing each other specific instances of love where we enter into deep relationships and commit to loving somebody, whether they change or not. That's what love really is. Love isn't, I will love you if you do what I want you to do. Love is, I will love you regardless of whether you change. It just doesn't matter. I love you. It's kind of like what we say to our kids. It doesn't matter what choices our kids make in life. We will love our children. And that's the kind of love that I think we're talking about. We're going to read in just a minute. You won't change anybody by gloating about how right you are or by climbing up on your self-righteous, enlightened high horse. There are some of us. It's funny how it works sometimes. It seems like the people that used to believe X and now believe why are often the most ungracious people around, right? They don't even honor the same journey that they went on. Just because they went on this journey a little bit ahead, then they get on their moral high horse. And I, again, just a reminder that that's not how it happens. See, here's the last thing I want to say, and then I'm going to read scripture. You can be right, whatever your position, you can be right. But you can hold that truth in such a way that you're wrong. And as a church, I want to remind us that what we are about, what it means to live in a big tent, is that we're all convinced we're right, right? You hold the opinions you do because you're right, and it's okay. But there's a way to hold that rightness in a way that's gracious and loving to people that I really actually love. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection, as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. John chapter 6. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias. Again, it's a reminder that John's audience is not familiar with this area, and so John keeps on, the author, the fourth evangelist, keeps reminding us of little details about the places that we're talking about. And so the Sea of Tiberias is a Roman name, and so they may not have known it as the Sea of Galilee. His audience obviously knew it as the Sea of Tiberias, so he lets them know. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. I've heard people teach these kinds of passages before, and they say things like, oh, there you go, they're just following Jesus because of the signs. How lame is that, right? Except, let's pause for just a minute. And if we live in this time, and we hear somebody's doing miracles, and we don't have DVRs, you can't pause it and check it out later, right? If you hear somebody's doing things like healing lame people and whole cities in Samaria are converting and he turned water into wine, I mean, that one enough makes you go, well, I may want to go check this out. There might be free wine, and if I'm sick, I might get cured. I mean, that's a normal reason. We see something happening. I want to be a part of that thing that's happening over there. That's totally no judgment. Can we agree on that? No judgment for these people. And sometimes when we get to these kinds of passages, we start judging them like, well, they're so lame. Now, there will be judgment coming later when we get to the very end of John 6. Just so you know, John 6 is one big literary narrative, and we're not going to do all of it today. We're only going to go through about verse 24. The next section, the I am a bread of life thing, is really dense. And so I might even split that up over the 5th and the 12th and kind of work through it, because it's a lot of stuff. We're going to basically hit the rest of the chapter, and there's 71 verses in this chapter in the next week or two. So they're following him because they see the signs that he's performing. He's healing the sick. And then verse 3, Jesus goes up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples, which is a pattern we see in the life of Jesus all the time. That as life gets busy, as things get intense, Jesus heads off and gets by himself. He retreats. Some of us are maybe pretty good at this, that we understand the idea of retreat. Some of us really struggle with the idea of retreat, right? Really struggle with the idea of, hey, things are busy, I ought to slow down. I was dropping my kids off last night, and I was talking to Eric Masters. He's like, so what was your day like? And I was like, you know, it was a really lazy day. I got up at 8 o'clock this morning, I went and helped my dad cut down a tree, and then I came back to the house, and I pulled weeds, and then I went to the pool for a couple hours. And he said something like, your definition of a lazy day is really different than other people's definition of a lazy day, when it starts with, I got up early and went and cut down a tree. I have a hard time with this, and I know maybe there's one or two of you like me in here, right? This idea of Jesus retreats to a mountainside. The thing's busy, and that's going to come back around in a couple minutes, this idea of retreating to a mountainside. And sometimes Jesus is by himself, and in this case, he sits down with his disciples. And it tells us in verse 4 that the Jewish Passover festival is near. And Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming to him. We find out later down in the passage in verse 10 is this great crowd is about 5,000 men. You tack on wives and children, and this crowd is 20,000 people maybe. There's a lot. That's a lot of people. I have a hard time wrapping my head around that number of people. And he said to Philip, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? And then the author tells us, he asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. So obviously Jesus later on, when Jesus told this story, he's like, hey, here's what, I already knew what I was going to do, but I thought it would be fun to just ask Philip. Like, Philip, what should we do? And Philip answers the exact same way that I would answer, right? Again, no judgment for Philip. There's a lot of people, and it's going to cost a lot of money to feed all these people, right? So let's pause for just a minute. What would be the best answer that we could hope for from Philip? Like what do we wish? If Jesus is doing a test, I'm going to play my hand here. Philip fails. What could he have answered that would have been like really good answers? Make your own bread, Jesus. I would love that attitude too. Make your... Yeah. Quote Jesus at Jesus. Yes. Love it. What else? Get the bread yourself. Maybe Philip could have said something like, you know, this seems like an impossible situation, but I saw you raise somebody that was lame for 38 years. I saw you take care of that situation. And there was the whole water into wine thing that happened. And so I don't know how we're going to do this, but I'm pretty confident you could. Wouldn't that be like a great answer from Philip? Like, I see that it's an impossible situation, but I think you could do something. The right answer is Jesus. Yeah, Jesus. But Philip answered, verse 7, it would take more than a half year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. Here's a boy with 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many? One of the commentaries that I was reading was like, Philip clearly gets an F in this test. Andrew at least gets a C. Andrew at least gets... Well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish for 5,000 people. I don't know how you're going to make that work, but this is what we have. At least he opens the door to something, right? Listen to this. This is great. In even realistically impossible situations, please give Jesus a little something, a little faith at least, a little credit for being able to do a great deal with the very little we have amidst all these people. Isn't that great? That maybe in this passage what we're called into is this idea of we're supposed to give Jesus just a little bit of credit, that maybe this seems really impossible, but if something can be done, I know you could do it. Hang on to that. We're going to pull all these pieces together in a little bit. Then Jesus said, have the people sit down. There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there, and Jesus took the loaves. He gave thanks. The word there is Eucharistus. He Eucharisted and distributed those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, gather the pieces that are left over, let nothing be wasted. So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Verse 15, I love this. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Again, this inclination of Jesus that when things start getting intense, like I'm backing up now, I'm going to hide. And that seems to be a pattern on the part of Jesus. Again, listen to this quote by this great theologian, Dale Bruner says, it's very hard for us mortals, even for us beginning to believe in Jesus mortals, to get Jesus right. Our first instincts seem so right, but we must constantly relearn Jesus on his own terms, right? That what Jesus is doing is he's in the process of teaching his followers how to relearn him. And one of the things we're going to find next week or the week after as we work through this bread of life stuff is that when we get to the end of it, we're going to find out that lots of people, once they start relearning Jesus, stop following. That signs are the entryway in, but at the end, they don't really last. That Jesus keeps asking them to relearn. And I think that's part of what this journey is, right? So this journey, the spiritual journey is never done. It's always one of peeling back more layers. And we think at any given moment, like, I've got Jesus figured out. I know my faith. I understand my faith. And then stuff happens in life. And then we have to re-examine it again. And we have to relearn Jesus again and who we thought Jesus would be. And in this case, they wanted him to be king because it seemed so obvious. He was healing people and he just fed a lot of people. And it's obvious he's the prophet who is to come. He's going to lead us. It's so obvious to us. And Jesus retreats and is like, not so much. Let's talk this through again. When evening came, verse 16, his disciples went down to the lake where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing and the waters grew rough. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were frightened. But he said to them, I am, don't be afraid. Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd, I'm going to skim through this stuff really fast. It's a little bit confusing. I'll hit it next week. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord gave thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. That section there is just really a setup for next week because verse 25 starts, when they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, Rabbi, when did you get here? And it leads into this bread of life passage. Here's a quick question I want to ask, and then I'm going to pull these two parables together really quickly for you. The parable or the healing of the lame man, who benefited there? It's not a trick question. The lame man, thank you. The miracle of turning water to wine that we saw earlier, who does that benefit? All the wine drinkers at the party, right? So, and it's particularly the wine snobs at the party, really like hit them really well, right? So miracles usually have a benefit to someone. Who benefits from this miracle? Okay, let me say this again. Who benefits from Jesus walking on water miracle? There's no clear reason Jesus does this, right? There's a level at which this feels like party trick, right? Like, hey, look what I can do. Because there's not anything that's pressing. It doesn't say that they're going to drown. It's just that they're kind of scared. A couple thoughts just briefly is one, somebody points out that Jesus cares about people's physical problems. And he also cares about the people eat. And he also cares that when we're afraid. Or some people have taken this and talked about how Jesus comes to us in the storms of our life, that Jesus comes walking to us in our storms if we just look, right? So there's some beautiful ways of thinking about this. Here's what I want to say about these two stories. Is both of these stories, the miracle doesn't seem to be the important thing, but that what's important in both of these stories is the reaction of those who follow him, right? In the first one, it's the reaction of Philip, and it's of Andrew, and the conversation Jesus has with Andrew, and how even though you've been closest to me and you've seen these things, when I ask you what can be done, you don't have a whole lot of faith that I can do anything. And then immediately they get in a boat, and it tells us how they're terrified, and they've, again, forgotten Jesus. That there seems to be in these stories not a lot of emphasis put on the miracles per se, but upon the relationship with his followers. It's funny in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, you think of like the Samaritan woman and Nicodemus, and some of these people are seen as heroes. And in the Gospel of John, the disciples seem like kind of bumbling idiots. But I love these bumbling idiots, right? Because they're my people. These people that stuff happens and it just doesn't stick, right? And I think one of the things that John is getting at, and we're going to get into this more in the next week or two, is this idea of the vapor effect, that external events don't last very long. They just don't. You can turn water into wine, you can heal people, you can feed them miraculously, and yet these kinds of events don't lead to deep, lasting faith. We want them to, but they just don't. Richard Rohr says, true spirituality is not a search for perfection or control or the door to the next world. Rather, it is a search for divine union now. The vapor effect tells us that if I can just get intervention right now. So let me back up. A year ago today, I did Doug and Emily's wedding in the morning, sweating a lot. And then I left their wedding and I went home and I moved our family out of our house. And we moved into an apartment. And a year ago today, at 10:30 at night, my oldest son and I walked through our house for the last time, and we cried together walking through our empty house for the last time. And we thought that was going to be the hardest day. And I've said some of this on my blog and a little bit here, but then we moved into an apartment, we started building a house, and then it turned to like minus 50,000 degrees cold in the winter. And we went through a season of life this summer where we lost some friends, and it was just really hard. And there came this moment in the middle of the winter where... I've shared this with a few people. I don't think I've said this up here yet, but there came this day, and I had left our apartment, and I'd gone out to the house to check on something, and we had to fire one of our contractors, which was a big drama and hard, and I went out to check on something, and then I came to my office, and then Jennifer called and needed me to do something at the house again, and so I was already mad. You know how these things are. She didn't ask anything wrong. I was just... Do you remember the movie Falling Down? I was getting to that moment, and so I went back to the house, and I was measuring something for her, and I went to climb over something, and I split my pants all the way up the inseam, and I just lost it. And I didn't say a word. I went and I got in my car, and I drove back to our apartment. I still didn't say a word, and Jennifer got nervous, and she followed me. And I walked to our apartment, I walked up the stairs, and I climbed back into bed with all my clothes on and pulled the sheets back over my head. And just, that was it. I was done. And I'm sure that's feeling similar to disciples on the water when you feel just so scared and so lost and you feel so alone and it feels so very dark. And in that moment, whatever your moment is, we all have our stories, right? In that moment, you want a sign. You want a miracle. You want Jesus to intervene because you think in that moment that if I can just get that sign, that miracle, that intervention, that thing that's going to happen, that's going to make everything right, if I just get that, it'll restore all my faith. Everything will be good again. Except that's a lie. Signs and miracles and those kinds of experiences are great, and they have their moment. But that's not what we really need in those moments. What we really need is a mystical encounter with God. Somewhere deep inside, we need to have an experience of God right here, right now, in my life as it actually is. I was listening to an interview yesterday with Richard Rohr, and it was this 2-hour-long interview, and he was talking about his own story. He grew up a Catholic in Kansas, really conservative, but he talked about when I was a boy, when I was, I think he was like in his teenage years, I had these experiences with God. He said, if I told you them, you would just think, whatever. But for me, they were deeply, profoundly an experience of God. It was something internal, something that happened inside of me, and that's what carries me in my ministry to these days. That's my calling or the thing that connects me to God. That keeps me going forward. And what I want for all of us, and I think some of the things I said at the beginning of the service, is it's not going to be intellect or chasing down the next experience or chasing down the next book. for me. Like, I'm a nerd. And I just keep on thinking, if I just read the next book, that book is going to make it all work out, right? If I just go to a conference, if I just go hear a speaker, if I just meet with this person, they will fix everything. And the thing I think I'm learning in my journey is that's just not true. It's one more miracle, one more thing, one more that is not going to fix things. But rather, what's going to change is when I start living in this moment and start looking for God everywhere. And so one of the things I've been working at in the last, since we got moved in and things have kind of, I guess, it's not as dark as it used to be. And we're moving forward and I'm trying to get healthy emotionally and spiritually and physically again. And I literally still cannot pick things up with my left hand. I still have no strength left in my left hand. It's hard. I went to pick up a 12-pack of soda the other day and I went, oh, I still can't. So there's still, you know, like things happen in life and it takes a while for your body to recover. At 41, it takes a lot longer than it used to. Some of you are rolling your eyes at me, I know. 41. But I think what I'm being called into is this moment of actually experiencing Jesus. That the disciples, what Jesus was asking his disciples to do was to enter in to this deep, profound experience of him. And what we're going to see, I said earlier, is what we're going to see in this passage is when it gets serious and Jesus talks about what this actually looks like, some people get off the journey because they just want the show. They just want the Steve Martin movie. Remember, what was that movie called? The one where he has the glittering jacket. And no, not Three Amigos. Nice. There's multiple movies in which Steve Martin has a glittering jacket. Who knew? Leap of Faith. Yeah. Leap of Faith. Some people just want that show, right? If we can just do the show. And yet I think what I'm learning and what I'm growing into, and this is, I'm going to stumble even more as we get further into this in just a minute, because it's at the kind of the bleeding edge of where I'm at right now, is that as much as I think I want the show is not what I want. What I want is a mystical, what we talked about last week, that mystical encounter with God. And I don't think, the temptation is to think that that comes someday. That I'll have that when I, whatever, when I go on vacation or when I'm at the beach, that's where I have the mystical encounter with God. When I go to the mountains, when I go to the city, when I go to whatever it is for you, or when I just have this certain group of friends or that certain group of friends, or if I do this thing, or if I just read that book, or if I just hear that sermon, or if I can just meet this person, whatever it is, we think that those things are the thing that's going to lead us into this mystical encounter with God. And in my experience, it's not. Rather, it's in the strangest moments, at the strangest times when we actually pay attention to what God is doing around us. One of the things that we say as a church that we believe that everything is spiritual, that God is always around us, that God is inviting us into every single moment. Not just the miracles, not just the feedings, not just the storms and the walking on water, but right here in this moment. And so I've been trying to pay attention to those things. Again, I'm going to quote Richard Rohr in his book, The Naked Now. He says, "It is living in the naked now, the sacrament of the present moment that will teach us how to actually experience our experiences, whether good, bad, or ugly, and how to let them transform us. Words by themselves will invariably divide the moment. Pure presence, let it be what it is as it is. When you can be present, you will know the real presence." Oh, isn't that great writing? "When you can be present, you will know the real presence. I promise you this is true, and it is almost that simple." And so this morning, the invitation is one that I guess I'm on the journey myself, is that of being present to this moment and asking in this moment, right, this one, not the one, not the idealized one tomorrow, but in this one, where is God in this moment? And I think there's some things, you know, I mean, nature is always right there, right? I mean, there's not a lot of good to say about living in central Illinois, but man, we have great sunsets, don't we? Just look up. We have beautiful, beautiful sunsets. The heavens declare the glory of God. Like, I think nature is just calling out to us. God is calling out to us to say, I'm here. Be in this moment. And so I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to be in these moments and not I'm an idealistic romantic in my head, right? Like I have all these notions of this is the way this event is going to go and it's going to be awesome. And you know what? They never go the way like they go in the movies, right? It's just never that beautiful or in soft focus enough. People just aren't that good looking, right? Like it just is never like it is in our heads. Our life is what it is. This is the life that we have. This is the space that God is trying to enter into. And it's not the one somebody else is living and it's not dependent on them. It's right here, right now, that God wants me. He wants you. He wants us to be in this moment, experiencing him here and now, and being with him on the mountain, and being with him in the storms, and being with him in all those places. And we don't need the miracles and all the show to get there. And so the invitation this morning is just really, really simple. It's almost this simple, right? Is to be with Jesus now. What is God calling you to right now? And maybe you leave here today. Maybe it's whatever you're doing this afternoon. Maybe it's laying by the pool. And what is it in this moment right now that I'm supposed to see? As I taste this food, what am I supposed to taste? In this moment with this person, what am I supposed to say? Or what am I not supposed to say? What is it in this gathering? How do I be here right now? And I'm not, I know I said this last week, but I'll tell you, I think for us, so much of it has to do with this, right? That the big first step for so many of us is if we're going to be present in this moment, we can't also be present to everybody else that we know. If I'm going to be present to you, I can't be present to everybody else I know. And so maybe this afternoon, this is an invitation or permission to go home and to shut off your phone and to be with the people you're with. And to be in the moment that you're actually in and the life that you're actually in. If I could go back and do it all over again, this is me, how I beat myself up all the time. If I could go back and do it all over again, I believe in that morning, laying in my bed in tears, I think God was in that moment. I think God was coming to me on the waters. That God wants to come into my life as it actually is. And the challenge is we just get so caught up, right? And I think it's so impossible. Where I'm at right now is so impossible. There's so many people to feed. It's a year's worth of wages just to give everybody a single bite. It's too big. But God wants to come to me in my actual life. That's huge. Will you join me in prayer? God, this feels like this morning the blind leading the blind. Or maybe the blind leading the enlightened is probably a better way to say it. But God, help us to live in this moment. We're so attracted to miracles and we're so attracted to the big shows and we want them and we want those experiences too, but those just don't last and we know it from our own experiences. We've been to camps and conferences and read books and had conversations and heard sermons and we thought that was going to change everything and we know that those are the vapor effect. They just disappear. But what we want really is this mystical union with you. Where we're aware of every moment that we're living into. And so, God, I pray this week that we take the time to find you. And God, maybe for some of us, we just ask maybe a little less subtlety. And when we need it, maybe we need something. Help us to be patient enough to look and disciplined enough to look. In your name I pray. Amen.